back to the Country House podcast. Today we're grateful to have Wilf Litton with us, who's an interior designer at Sybil Colfax, and he'll be joining us to continue our series on Sir John Vanbrugh's houses. And today we're going to discuss King's Weston, which is in the Bristol area. And King, obviously in the name, there's a royal link to it, but not in the current state that it is. But we'll get into that. But you'll probably recognize this by its characteristic feature of the chimney arcades on the top. The rest of it, you know, quite normal looking, but that adds a significant difference to it. Jeff, where do we start with this one?
I think we start, Ben, with talking about the history of the house, perhaps, and when it was built, who it was built for. And then we'll talk about how it's changed hands over time and how it's sort of matured and developed over the centuries. So King's Weston, as Ben mentioned, is in the village of, or the ward of Bristol now, was the village of King's Weston, just outside Bristol, but it's now part of Bristol. And King's Weston is an extraordinary Vanbrugh house. It's one of his smaller houses. It's still quite a substantial building, but it's not on the scale of Castle Howard or Blenheim. But it was built at the beginning of the 18th century. It was started in 1712 by Vanbrugh, so it fell sort of towards the middle to end of Vanbrugh's time of practice, and it was completed in 1719. And it was built for the Southwell or Southall family. I'm not entirely sure whether it's pronounced Southall or Southwell. I suspect it's Southall. And it was built on the site of an earlier Tudor house. And Edward Southall, who was an Anglo-Irish lawyer and politician, commissioned Vanbrugh to build the house. He sat in the House of Commons for various different constituencies. And he had married quite a wealthy heiress as well. He had married Elizabeth Cromwell, the 8th Baroness Cromwell. And between them, they had built this beautiful sort of compact stately home, a square block, really, in sort of golden sandstone, not dissimilar to Blenheim, the stone, that sort of the Bath stone that everyone knows about. And as Ben mentioned, it's got some really interesting features. So it's clearly English Baroque, but it's not as sort of ostentatious as Castle Howard or Blenheim. So we talked in our episode on Vanbrugh's practice that he became more restrained over time. So in his early years, when he was building Castle Howard and Blenheim, he was very much taken with the European Baroque from his time in Europe as a British spy. And so he loved all the ornamentation, the finials, the urns, the balustrading, the pilasters and pediments and capitals and all these sorts of things that we've talked about before. But as we mentioned in that biographical episode on Vanbrugh, towards the end of his period, Baroque was falling out of fashion. Palladianism was becoming more fashionable. So he became more restrained, ultimately building Seton Delaval, his last major project, which was sort of a Baroque Palladian house in the north of England. But King's Weston, again, you see sort of a classical simplicity, but also with beautiful ornamentation that's typical of the Baroque. The Corinthian capitals on the main entrance facade, you've got a pediment with a semicircular window in the pediment instead of a crest, and then a series of pilasters with Corinthian capitals. So the pilasters being like columns, but half sort of stuck to the wall, for our listeners who aren't sure what pilasters are. So as opposed to pillars, they're sort of protrude out from the wall, but are a part of the wall. And the capitals being the crowning caps at the top, which, as we've talked about, come in different classical orders. So the simplest being Doric, then Ionic, then Corinthian, being the most extravagant. I think that's sort of a rough outline of the house and a brief history. I don't know if Wilf has any thoughts on how or can tell us a bit more about how the house sort of developed over time.
Yes. So firstly, thanks so much for having me join you today. As you say, the house is a much more pared back design from that sort of Baroque style. And it obviously has the hallmarks of Van Burst's work from his other designs. And you mentioned Blenheim. The chimney arcade, as you described, on top of the house, it sort of sits almost like a crown on top of it. And it's sort of reminiscent of the belvederes that are seen on Van Burst's other work at Castle Howard and also on Blenheim. So you can see elements of design there, but as Jeff says, it's much more restrained. And I wonder, and this is purely speculative, but whether that was partly related to the political upheaval at the time. You had a sort of change or a tension in government as they were moving to a two-party political system. There were rumors of assassination plots on the Queen. And so there was this sort of sense of maybe this ostentatious, this more ostentatious style falling out of favor and a sort of move to something that was a bit, made you less of a target in the sort of the British political establishment. But that's sort of my idle speculation about where these design choices might have come from, or what might have been the pressures that were happening at the time. So I, as you mentioned also with the name King's Weston, slightly unusual name for a sort of grand house, but it sort of makes sense. So that the name first appears in the Domesday Book, and it's sort of not long after the Norman Conquest. And at the time, the estate, as you say, was property of the crown, and that's since changed. The king's part of it refers to the fact that it was owned by the crown. And then Weston is a portmanteau of west and tun, which was the Saxon word for settlement. So it simply means a settlement in the western part of what was then Britain under Henry II. The house was commissioned in the early 18th century, and it took about 10 years to build. And it came with a variety of outbuildings, including its own brew house, which produced a special beer made for the estate. So obviously they were very keen drinkers there. And then it stands, sort of changes ownership a handful of times over the next 100 or 200 years. And then it takes on a a lot of rapid change occurs from the 20th century onwards. You have the building being used first as a hospital for wounded soldiers during the First World War. On the sort of in the lead up to the Second World War, there are various changes that result in the building being developed and its outbuildings being developed into a primary school. And that sort of gets put to one side during the Second World War when it gets requisitioned by the War Office. It then later does become a school for a brief period. And then, really interestingly, it gets falls into the hands of the local authority, and it's then used as a police training center for a number of years before it was abandoned in 1995. At which point the house is in quite substantial disrepair. And it's not until the turn of the millennium when it returns to being used as a home. And that's really when the sort of modern, the kind of restoration of the heritage building begins in earnest. So that's a sort of potted history of the house over the last couple of hundred years.
Thanks for that, Wilf. It's interesting going back to the commission because, as you said, and we've described this in, we kind of speculated about this too in our episode about Sir John Vanbrugh of, was it his kind of radical politics or the politics of the times that was making him do smaller, less ostentatious houses? And I was reading about the commission of King's Weston, and it it looked like Edward Southwell, he had come into some money from the death of his wife. It's a lovely story about how he met his wife. They were on a voyage, and there was a storm. I think she was called Lady Daring. There was a storm, and he was impressed by her fortitude and calmness during the voyage, and that's how they met. So I thought that's quite nice. But she died in childbirth, and he inherited a lot of money from that. And so with that newfound money, wanted to really improve King's Weston, and so wanted the most eminent architect he could find, which was Sir John Vanbrugh. However, saying to him, he didn't want a grand palace, but a practical yet imposing family home overlooking the River Severn and inspired by the rugged and exposed beauty of the area. So there was kind of this balance of a modern house with an ancient castle on the hill as the ships came into Bristol. And so I wonder if Vanbrugh had to reel back some of his desires, and it maybe was less about the politics, although saying that he also wanted to put this huge terrace, an elevated promenade, and that was too much, so they took that away. But I do find that a really interesting conversation, because it is such a big change from what we see at Castle Howard and Blenheim.
Mm. That's really helpful, Ben. I think thinking about the property that was on the site before King's Weston House, as we see it today, was built, when Sir Robert Southwell purchased the estate, there was a late Tudor house on the site, and you can find Johannes Kipp's etching of the estate that he did, I guess, in the late 17th century, and you can see how different it was. Both the house, of course, being late Tudor, with a three-sided entrance court and all sorts of turrets and various other sort of classic Tudor ornamentation. But also, what's striking is the park, which is not a park actually; it's formal gardens. So it is largely open and not planted, but there are parterres, there are avenues, a lot of formal gardens, and the view of the Severn. And of course that changed under the Southwells. They planted the gardens more as a traditional sort of parkland landscape. But when the Southwells commissioned Vanbrugh, they actually kept some of the foundations of the old house. They built the house on the site of the Tudor house. As you go round the house, it's very much sort of a square block. So you've got on each side, there is sort of a protruding central bay made up of three window bays, which are slightly smaller. And then two or three, depending on the side of the house, bays on either side. So the main classical facade that you see, that with the Corinthian capitals that I mentioned already in the pediment, you've got it's a four-story house. You've got a sunken lower ground floor, basement, a flight of steps up to the piano nobile, the upper ground floor. You've then got a principal second story, and then you've got the attic story. And we mentioned already the arcaded chimneys, which are very unusual in any building in the country, because what they would have had to do is they would have had to, essentially all the chimneys are arranged as a turret-like formation in the center, like a crown, like Wolf said. And what they would have had to do is they would have had to angle the chimneys so that the chimneys on the outer rooms would have gone in, so that they could all come up through these central chimney stacks, which is very interesting. And the house, of course, was remodeled, as a lot of houses were. So although it was one of Vanbrugh's smaller houses, and arguably the severest and plainest in style, it was praised perhaps more highly than some of Vanbrugh's other houses. We've talked already about the controversy surrounding Blenheim, linked primarily to Vanbrugh's relationship with the Duchess of Marlborough. But what you get with King's Weston is you see, like we've talked about in other episodes, the gradual evolution of the country house. So it was remodeled quite a few times before it left the Southwell family's ownership. So it was remodeled in the late 18th century, in fact, not even that late, mid to late 18th century, 1763 to 68, by Robert Milne, who was an architect and an engineer, in fact. And then it was remodeled again between 1845 and 1850 by Thomas Hopper, who was the favoured architect of George the Fourth. So Thomas Hopper was very fashionable at the time of the sort of early to mid 19th century for renovating and updating country houses. So he didn't build many houses from scratch, but he worked on a lot of houses, updating them, bringing them more modern Victorian amenities, and so forth. So yeah, two of the facades of Vanbrugh's original four facades, two of them were remodeled by Robert Milne, who also remodeled the interior, and we'll get onto the interior in a minute. But the stone, interestingly, which is this lovely sort of yellow bath stone, sort of that was ochre originally, but has sort of weathered to a lighter sort of almost pinky color, was actually all quarried on the site. So from a, you know, these days architects talk all about being sustainable. Yet more often than not, they ship in concrete and steel from all over the world. And actually this is a very sustainable house for many reasons. The primary reason being, of course, that it's still standing 300 years on, which is more than can be said for most modern buildings, most modern houses. So it's a very sustainable house from that perspective. It's also, it was also built of local stone. So, you know, it's like tangent, but, you know, sustainability is the buzzword in architecture and design at the moment. Yet I think you'll find many of these modern buildings with their green roofs and triple glazing are less sustainable than a house like King's Weston, which has stood the test of time. Its beauty is objective. It's never gone out of fashion. It's never gone, and it's never been knocked down because it's a beautiful, well-built house. So slight tangent there for our listeners, but it's important when we think about building, you know, and we will in due course do an episode on modern country houses and current country house architects, but it's important to think about what makes the house timeless, because it is exactly the timeless nature of our country houses that has allowed them to stand the test of time. Just before I jump into the interiors with Wilf's probably greater knowledge than mine on country house interiors, but I'll just quickly describe for our listeners the different facades. So you've got the entrance facade, which I mentioned, which has these six Corinthian pilasters, a pair on each side, and then two more in the middle. And the pediment at the top, as I mentioned, rather unusually for Vanbrugh, doesn't have a family crest, but has a lunette, which is a sort of half moon, a crescent shaped or half moon shaped window in the pediment. And then there are vases on the parapets. So the parapet being like a balustrading, but solid. So it sort of hides, it sort of is on top, on the roof line, essentially, of the house, above the top story. We talked about balustrading in houses like Highgrove, which are essentially sort of little columns of stone with a sort of banister on top, like a sort of fence of stone around the top of a house. But a parapet is sort of a solid version of that. So you have the parapet with urns or vases at each corner. And then there's the southeast facade, which has a central Doric temple front with an open pediment. So this is the facade I mentioned, which has three bays in the middle and then three on either side. And it's rather unusual because it's got this sort of stepped top to it, like a sort of Egyptian monument, which again, we mentioned that Vanbrugh was quite interested in Egyptian architecture as well. He did the water tower and which doubled as the gate at Blenheim, which was sort of built in an Egyptian style. But there's a central Doric templed front with an open pediment, And then the attic, the center has an attic in the upper story. And the only decoration on that side of the house is the rustication of the temple, sort of protruding temple-like sort of bay, which is rusticated pilasters. So those are the two primary facades, the most decorated facades. The other two facades of the house, which Vanbrugh designed very, very plainly and undecorated. And these were the ones that were largely reworked at a later date because they were the less attractive size of the house. And then you have the northwest facade, which is essentially a flat surface with a Venetian window on each floor. And to improve the view down to Avonmouth, the center was remodeled by Milne with a canted bay, so a bay window, which sticks out from the house in a way that Vanbrugh would not have approved of, but which made the most of the beautiful views down to the water. So perhaps now we can sort of move inside and think a little bit about the plaster work, the collection, and so forth. Wilf, what are your thoughts on the interiors of King's Weston?
So I think the most notable thing to mention, we've talked about the chimney arcade on the roof and how unusual that is. But perhaps the other unusual feature inside the house is the floating staircase, which I think is only one of two examples that exist in the world. So the floating staircase runs around a triple height space in the center of the house. And it's apparently renowned to bend as one walks up it. This area is part of Hopper's renovations of the house. So in that hallway, the original stone colonnades were replaced with metal beams, and the design itself is quite simple and almost utilitarian for a building of this sort. And then the other area that's really interesting is the salon, which again is a triple height space, and it's full of family portraits. You've got Robert Southwell and Robert's wife Helena, and Edward Southwell and Lady Elizabeth, who was his wife. You essentially have an array of family portraits surrounding you as you come into this room, all the way three tiers up to the ceiling. And each of those is set in a trompe l'oeil frame. And then around the ceiling, you have these large format plaster frieze bordering the ceiling. And then again, another feature of this design are these sort of cross-banded decorations across the ceiling with a Greek key pattern. And this also seems to have been another influence on the sort of design of the interiors, another kind of classical motif that we see. And these are reflected throughout the house.
Wilf, I'm fascinated by some of the colours used in the interior as well. That staircase hall is almost like a really bold orangey peach. There's hints of turquoise in there, and obviously the saloon is this beautiful light blue. And in other rooms I could go on with these bold choices for colors. Was this indicative of that period? Because I imagine it's a significant difference to what it would have looked like before the refurbishment.
Ben, I have to confess, my investigations into the colours have not, I haven't gone that far, so I couldn't give you a very honest answer as to what might have been the reasoning for why they used these very bold colours.
I think it's hard to tell with a house that's been renovated so often and changed hands so many times, what colours would have been original to its building and what aren't. I'm just I was reading about there were plans that were released not too long ago about the Southall's interiors, but again the family brought in all these architects and designers again over so many years, so it's hard to tell really what colors were original. But there are drawings by Vanbrugh of the original interiors, so you can't see the colors, but you can get a sense of what was there before people like Milne and Hopper got their hands on King's Weston and sort of made changes. So there is, just looking at the rooms were named the Throwley Chamber, the Kinsale Chamber, the Eating Parlour, and these rooms can't actually be located now. They're not sure which rooms there are because they've changed names. They only assume that the Eating Parlour was the principal ground floor room. There was the State Bed Chamber and various others. But there is a letter from Edward Southall dated December 1713 when he writes, "I've almost forgot what I wrote about the two chimney pieces, but if I remember right, I desired one according to the wooden model I sent, which being large was to go into the great parlour. The other I desired for a bed chamber of the common chamber size and of the Italian moulding, if you fit, to put it in the room I call Burton." So there are bits about what King's Weston rooms may have looked like. And actually, it's thought that they would have been panelled, a bit like you see at Dereham Park, which is another great English Baroque house near Bath that we've mentioned in past episodes. It was built by William Tellman, who was famous for doing the majority of the work at Chatsworth. But if you look at the rooms at Dereham, you see a lot of wooden panelling and plaster work, but it's not these bright painted colours that you see at King's Weston today, which are probably, if they weren't recent additions, would have been perhaps Regency additions or later. I don't know if that answers your question a bit, Ben.
No, yeah. I just know there are some colours that you would associate with Georgian times and other periods. So I wondered about that. But Wilf, I would love if you could provide an insight, because I have no idea about this, of how, you know, when the South Wales or the Southalls, however you pronounce it, would commission these renovations and refurbishments. As an interior designer, would they have taken that as sort of a blank canvas and gone for it? But traditionally, how much involvement would the client have in a commission of that sort?
I mean, I think it's fair to say that Hopper was quite his sort of interventions were quite broad and encompassing. So I would have imagined they wouldn't have held back from decorating or redecorating as they wanted to. I think in terms of how you see the house now, as Jeff pointed out, it's sort of been through various iterations. And of course, having fallen into such disrepair, it's quite likely a lot of the original finishes were damaged beyond repair and or stripped out. So it's very hard to sort of take a look at what we see now and relate that back to something historic. I think in terms of the relationship with the clients at the time, all we have to go on is the commission that Edward Southall gave to Vanbrugh. And I don't know whether any similar document exists for what he asked Hopper to then do later with the remodeling of the interiors. It's possible that that Edward was quite hands-on and wanted to have quite a say over the decoration. And it may have been, he may have been influenced by his own interests. He spent time between the UK and Ireland, was a very much a political figure, but had a legal background. But we don't really know enough about him as a person, or I certainly don't know enough about him as a person, to sort of give you a convincing answer as to how involved he was in the design and the redecoration of the house.
I think Wilf, you mentioned that there's evidence that he was somewhat involved, and Ben's touched on that with his quite clear remit that Vanbrugh had to work with. But it's clear that the Southwells were quite involved based on these drawings that came out not too long ago, like I mentioned, of some of the original interiors, which were sadly lost. So chimney pieces, mantles, and so forth. And what's interesting is there's a letter from 1716, so towards sort of midway through the construction of the house. The family actually moved in 1716, but they were still doing drawings dated 1718. So the house clearly hadn't finished when the family moved in, and they were therefore very hands-on towards the end of their time, towards the end of Amber's time building the house, because they were in the house and they had their eye on what they wanted doing. And it seems that Helena Legrand, Edward Southwell's older sister, had been delegated with setting up the house before he moved in. It was in this letter from 1716, it says she was fully employed in transposing and setting the furniture, pictures, and chainy. And you can see her drawings. So there are drawings that she did of fire surrounds, and she specified that they be wrought out of ash color marble. So she clearly had clear ideas of what she wanted doing for her brother. And that's sadly all we really have on the interiors. So we'll never really know what the staterooms on the ground floor were like when Vanbrugh constructed them. We know that the first floor chambers were not particularly over the top. But again, like I said, you know, during those years when the house was derelict and falling apart, much of the ornamentation was stripped away and sold or destroyed, which makes it much harder to know. But I think, you know, before we sort of come to an end, it's important to mention something about King's Weston, which is that apart from being the only house outside, the only city outside of London to possess a building designed by Vanbrugh, Bristol, where King's Weston is. So all Vanbrugh's other houses are country houses, and then there's some work by Vanbrugh in London, but Bristol's the only other city that has a Vanbrugh work. It's important to note that in addition to that, there are more Vanbrugh buildings at King's Weston than any other estate in the UK. So you have lots of follies and outbuildings that were all designed by Vanbrugh. So although Castle Howard, for example, which has a lot of Vanbrugh follies, Castle Howard also had follies designed by many other architects. Likewise, Blenheim has a few follies, again, designed by other architects, whereas the outbuildings at King's Weston are largely by Vanbrugh. So you've got the brew house on the grounds, which was built sort of towards the end of the construction of the house, around 1718. And it includes wonderful architectural features, including a massive keystone above the arched doorway. That lunette window, like the one that we see in the central pediment of the main house. There's an arcade across the parapet, which is again a feature typical to Vanbrugh, and could also be found at Vanbrugh Castle, which is Vanbrugh's own home that he did in near Blackheath, near Greenwich, in East London. And what's interesting about that is the sort of molded parapet, which is on the brew house, is a very sort of over the top example of Gothic revival. So again, we saw Vanbrugh bringing in his different tastes in architecture. He was criticized often for being ostentatious or precocious, but he did combine sort of elements of Gothic and Egyptian with Baroque. Then you've got another folly in the grounds is called the Echo, which is a loggia at the end of the southeast axis of the house. So a loggia being a sort of arcaded folly with a facade of four central piers or columns of rusticated stonework. We've talked about rustication before. It's where the stonework is sort of made to be like blocks of different sizes stacked together. And the rustication makes it look more weathered as well. And what you see is you see an alternation of projected and vermiculated stone blocks that build up these piers or these columns. Then you've got the banqueting loggia, which is another loggia that was added to a pre-existing banqueting house, and Vanbrugh's new front turned the axis of the building so it would relate better to the main house and the terrace and the promenade into the woods. So again, you see it's now been converted into a private house, but it's sort of a Venetian window style entrance. It's not glazed, but you have a central arched doorway with two sort of rectangular lower entrances on either side with columns in the middle, which is lovely. And then there are lots of gate lodges as well. So there was the Penpole Lodge, which was perhaps the grandest lodge at King's Weston, which looks not dissimilar to William Kent's hunting lodge at Badminton that we've talked about before. And for those listeners of ours who follow us on Instagram, they would have seen it on our Instagram, this wonderful enormous sort of gated temple at Badminton. And the Penpole Lodge was very similar. There was a room above and then a wider sort of central portion underneath with an arch in it. And then I think the other buildings, so Penpole was one of I think seven gate lodges. And then of course there was like all country houses that we talked about in the past. There was a stable block. There was an inn. There was a blacksmith's cottage. And some of these buildings still stand. Some of them have been destroyed, but it's a wonderful reminder of the broader nature of the estate, because when King's Weston was built, it wasn't part of Bristol. Bristol was a smaller city, especially because it was pre-industrial revolution. So it would have been a complete estate with all the follies and avenues and woods and hills and parkland that you expect.
Yeah, I think that's right. And all of it would have had an architectural language which linked all of these buildings and the main house and the gardens and the parkland together. And sadly, some of that has been lost. So it's quite hard to see it, look at it in its modern format and see how these different buildings and different landscaping designs would have fitted together.
I think a nice sort of anecdote is the great Christian leader of the 18th century, John Wesley, who people will know of because of the many hymns he wrote, along with his other members of his family. John Wesley was based in Bristol for a while, and it was his brother Charles Wesley who wrote some of the most famous hymns that we sing in churches today, like Love Divine or Love's Excelling and Christ the Lord Has Risen Today. And John Wesley was a theologian who visited King's Weston in 1783. And he had two very lovely comments to make about it. Firstly, he commented that the woods at King's Weston are amazingly beautiful. I've seen nothing equal to them in the west of England and very few in other parts. And in a subsequent visit, he noted the house to be one of the most beautiful I ever saw. The prospect is fine every way, commanding both the land and the water. And others have described the house as exquisitely beautiful and uncommonly extensive. So there was very high praise for King's Weston. And what's interesting is this praise came towards the end of the 18th century when Baroque had fallen out of fashion and the classical simplicity of Palladianism was much more popular. Yet King's Weston, because it was one of Vanbrugh's more austere buildings, remained fashionable throughout the time of the Regency and later. And we're very lucky that it's still standing today, because it could very easily have been lost many times.
Yeah, we have to remember too that it's mentioned in Jane Austen's Emma and Northanger Abbey. It was clearly a really revered house, the Great Weston Estate. People would travel from all around to have an excursion there, especially because of those spectacular views of the Avon River, which segues naturally into its decline in the 19th century when it was bought by the new owners, the Miles family. The Miles family were extremely wealthy. I think Philip Miles was the first millionaire in Bristol. And Philip's first son, Philip Skinner Miles, created the Avonmouth Dock, which was to be built on the lower marshland stretching along the boundary of the estate. And to link that new dock to the city, they had planned a railway, but the railway cut off the estate from the banks of the Avon and passed right through the park. So the innovations of the Industrial Revolution led to the decline of the King's Weston estate, because the views which it was so famous for were blighted by this big industrial view of the dock and the railway. But there is kind of something I love about it is its links after Skinner Miles to Philip Napier Miles, who was a great musician and philanthropist. And as per my research, I had no idea of this, but King's Weston under his stewardship was where the Lark Ascending originated, you know, Sir Ralph Vaughan Williams' very famous piece, which wasn't famous at the time, but he was a regular visitor to King's Weston, and it was on one visit he completed that to showcase the skill of Napier Miles, one of his proteges, who was to perform in one of their local concerts. And Vaughan Williams also had a melody written in the 20th century that he named after King's Weston. So there's a sort of trivial fact for you to end what is sort of a sad decline of what was once a beautiful parkland and view. And with that, I think that's a good place to close. Thank you all for joining us. Wilf, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your insights. I hope you'll come back to us for another episode sometime. And for those listening, thank you, and do join us again next week. Goodbye.